question I want to lead off with, and I hope it's of interest to many of you, that we've been talking about love in two different ways today, it seems to me. That on the one hand, for Teilhard, love is expressed in its most physical form as that power of attraction. You know, he's got a wonderful line somewhere in the human phenomenon that says love is the reverberation of the imprint in the heart of every element of the psychic convergence of the universe. He says the physical structure of the universe is love, and he tends to equate love with this force of attraction. So I was going to ask you if you could nuance a little, what's the distinction for you? What's the difference between attraction and compulsion? Maybe I could say a little bit more about where I'm going with it, because, you know, in terms of the love and the teaching and the things like that, that we know as human beings that attraction can get us into a hell of a lot of trouble. And attraction, until something transforms in us, can bring us into that dark world of compulsion, of obsession, that leads to sex trafficking, that leads to violation and degradation of human beings, codependency, all that. And surely that can't be the love that Teilhard's talking about that's leading us to higher consciousness. So could you unpack that for us a little?
Well, I could try to at least to have some points here. And I think one thing is that love, for Teilhard, love takes what's deepest within us, you might say, and joins us to another. And so the idea of attraction is what is deepest. So I think I would say emphasize what is deepest within us is a precondition for what joins us to another. And I think without that attraction, is that center within me is, in a sense, drawn to the center in another. And so I move toward that other, and that's, I think, what he means by attraction. I move toward that other in deep respect, in mutuality, in dialogue, with recognizing that the other is not me, and therefore I am drawn to that other as part of myself and yet other than myself. And so there's, you know, I think for Teilhard, it's always having that withinness and withoutness. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I think of his relationship with Lucille Swann, the artist that Teilhard loved, a person who loved Teilhard, an artist in Paris who became friends with Teilhard and really became a prime supporter of Teilhard, who really was his only ally at one point in his life when his Jesuit superiors were refraining, you know, confining him from publishing his things. Lucille, you know, truly stood by Teilhard's side. She was with him. She's the one who dialogued with him. She's the one who was, in a sense, the love that kept him going. And yet at one point, you know, she said, you know, Teilhard, you know, I want to get married. You know, I want to consummate our love, you know, and he said, I can't. You know, I am really committed to a deeper love within me, and namely that love of God within him that he felt deeply committed to. And so while he loved Lucille Swann, he was deeply, you know, attracted to her, I think, physically and emotionally, and yet there was a love even greater than physical love itself. So I think for Teilhard, I think love is, it is on the level of the physical, but it's the depth of the physical. In other words, it's deeper, and he himself would do what Thomas Merton says, and that is, we have many loves, but we have to name the priority of our loves. What do we truly love? Who do we truly love? In other words, we cannot love sort of all over the place. You know, you cannot love everyone, or you can't love everything equally. And so I think Teilhard, I think he prioritizes his loves, and God becomes the first love of his heart. And that, in a sense, allows him to be drawn to ideas, to be drawn to persons. And I think that difference from compulsion, where we lose the sense that there is a first love within us. Compulsion then becomes need. It becomes addiction. It becomes then a total control of the other for one's own lack of something within oneself. And I think compulsion I see as the reverse of attraction. Attraction comes from the inner outer. Compulsion is this addiction to the outer that either is for one's selfish reason or one thinks can fulfill that which lacks within oneself. And I think that is exactly what Teilhard did not do. He did not have a compulsive love. He had what I might call a gentle love of attraction. You know, I could see him moving toward ideas, even ideas themselves, you know, that there's a certain love there as we're moving toward, you know, that which is pulling us. But always with a respect, always in a sense, with a sense of self moving toward other. And I think that's what attraction's about, self moving toward other, not as other as that which can satisfy my needs. You know, we have a lot of self-gratification, I think, with compulsion. And it's very, it can become very narcissistic, you know, and that's where we do get to the trafficking and the complete annihilation of personhood. Teilhard is always about the person or the personal. And so love and the attraction of love is always toward person or the personal, and not making the person into an it. You know, when we reduce persons to objects of control and that we can control those objects for my needs or my self-gratification, then we have, you might say, the corruption of love.
Yeah. So you would say then that at the level of us human beings, truly human beings, as opposed to, you know, the mitosis or the mating of cells or, you know, that it needs to be one deep calling to the another.
Exactly. Deep calls to deep.
And that what he means by attraction is deep calls to deep.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if you want to call it that, the purity of that deep calling to deep, and the power of it is maintained and deepened, by not taking.
Right.
But always having in mind what gives, what creates the becoming for the beloved. Or
right. I mean, I think true love is not consumption.
Yeah.
True love is the opposite. It's fecundity, it's generation, it's outward moving.
Yeah.
You know, and at the same time, it's receptivity. I think true love requires not that we go out to the other, but at the same time, we make space for the other. We, in a sense, allow that other to enter into our world.
Yeah. So it's kind of like in human beings that are gifted with self-reflective consciousness, then, that eros, that attraction, has to be kind of submitted to some form of kenosis or letting be.
Exactly.
Or making space in order for it to be transformed into the love that,
right,
that he's talking about.
And that's why I think eros and agape are deeply intertwined.
Yeah.
No true eros, no true desire without making space, agape, kenosis.
Yeah.
You know, for that other, for that object of desire or that person of desire to not only receive what we are in a sense extending, but to receive them into ourselves.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I've sat and pondered much over Teilhard and Lucille Swann, because they're you know, the collection of the letters of them is so brilliant, and it's clear that the love was
real.
Deep and mutual.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, you know, father pair Teilhard and the little lowly, but, you know,
no,
he talked about
it as love.
Two
it was
wild geese that are flying together in
yeah.
the same direction. But it seems to me that Lucille, in her, you know, she rightly nailed him and said, well, hey, if you're into incarnation, if you're into materiality, you know, why not consummate?
Right,
you know?
Why not?
It seemed a little contradictory. And Teilhard was himself really clear that he didn't want anything with the old models of just renunciation, push it away. But my take, and I wonder what your take is, is that he really felt himself as a man under authority, as they said in his, and that it was only in the adherence to his vows. That he could maintain the purity that would allow love to transform.
Right.
The particularity of one element,
right,
you know, into another, to transform into something that could become the body of a universal.
I think that's true, but I think, you know, and I think with that, I think we could maybe just highlight that Teilhard from an early age was really grasped by the Sacred Heart of Christ.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that, you know, that heart really grasped Teilhard in his deep heart. And, you know, I think that's what a religious vocation is something about, you know, mm-hmm. because many people can't understand, like, you know, how could you remain celibate for your life? You know, how mm-hmm. how do you live this life? And it's like being grasped deep within by a deep love that it's sort of it's incomprehensible to many people, but it's as deep as having a sexual union, you know, in a marriage,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that's the whole thing that I think that it wasn't just under vows. I think like I made these vows and I need to keep them. That vow was his deep commitment mm-hmm. to what had grasped him early in his life,
yeah.
and he felt committed to, you know, and as much as he loved Lucille, that love couldn't trump or triumph over that initial love, you know, of Christ.
Yeah, it was really kind of interesting in that, because it would have been so simple in a way that, you know, he could have said, to hell with the church, to hell with the Jesuits.
Would have been a lot easier.
Married Lucille, moved back to Paris, and had an absolute wonderful career being endured by the intelligentsia, published all his books, you know. I mean, it would have been a perfect success story.
That is really true. I mean, and so many of his friends said, Teilhard, what is wrong with you?
Yeah.
You know, why are you doing
why
this?
Why beat a dead horse? You know?
But it tells us that... It tells us the depth. In other words, his Christocentric vision, mm-hmm. there's a depth to this vision that is more than just an idea or a theory. Mm-hmm. There is something that was deep, deep, deeply rooted in Teilhard in this Christogenic vision of evolution.
Yeah.
And he felt that the Catholic Church, you know, embodied the vision that he had grown into.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, to everyone else, this just seemed totally ludicrous, you know, why he would stay in a church and in a religious organization that actually had suppressed him and taken away his voice.
Yeah.
And there's something about what grasped Teilhard early on that he could not renounce.
That's so interesting. and you know, without making a blanket statement that says celibacy is the way that you have to do it, it's clear that integrity is the way you have to do it. And that he felt so clear in the heart of hearts that if he threw it over, that it would all get flat and ordinary.
Yeah.
And that what he brings,
right,
to the world, and I think what communicates to people today, is that essence of the transformed suffering of love.
Yes.
And that's what speaks to the deeps of heart. So he made his life a crucible.
Yes. So two things that you say here, Cynthia, that are really important. One, the integrity of his life. When we live out of the truth of our personhood. In other words, we are, each one of us is endowed with gifts and personality, and we have a sort of, you know, we have a role to play. You know, we have something, there's something about our lives that's essential to this ongoing emergent whole. And Teilhard knew his role, so to speak. And he grasped that deep within him.
Mm-hmm.
And he could not in any way, as much as he loved Lucille, and he really loved Lucille, you know, and she loved him. But he could not, in a sense, consummate that love. He could not relinquish, that you might say, the truth of his own self, what was that deep at the heart of his life. And so it's not about celibacy or not celibacy. It's about truth and integrity, you know, and therefore living out of our true personhood. That was really important to Teilhard. And then the second thing, what was the second point? The crucible.
The crucible,
What love doesn't go through the cross? Right? What love doesn't go through suffering? You know, any love, if it's real, it will suffer. Mm-hmm. It will go through dark nights and painful nights. It will go through, you know, long periods of droughts.
Yes.
Because that's what love does. Love endures through it all. You know, because there is something there that you know, I think John of the Cross is sort of the master in this way, mm-hmm. you know. And mm-hmm. Teilhard's own omega centricity, you know, that through the darkness and the sufferings and the misunderstandings and the rejections, there's something of, in that darkness, there's a light. Yeah. You know, it's like dark energy.
Yeah.
You know, there's a light trapped within.
Yeah. And it transforms through the mechanism.
That's it, transformative. That's,
because when you come back to it and think about it in terms of the modern age, and nowadays, you know, I've talked with many abbots, you know, and they say, you know, today celibacy isn't the issue, obedience isn't the issue. People say, this isn't working for me, you know, screw it.
Yeah, right.
And Teilhard, if he had been a proper green level of consciousness modern person, would have said, screw it, you know.
Yeah.
I think what communicates and what transforms is this crucified love.
Exactly. And I think in our modern age, we give up too easily. You know, we say, screw it, right?
Yeah.
We're not going to be part of this. We're out of here.
Yeah.
But we have to know what is deeply grasping us, you know, and is it worth to unscrew?
Yeah.
You know, is it worth to let go of?
Yeah.
And I think we're too superficial.
Mm-hmm.
We're too emotionally driven. And I think for Teilhard, what I see in him is a deep thinker.
Mm-hmm.
He's deeply reflective about his life.
Yeah.
He's not emotionally reactive about it.
Mm-hmm.
Even as he's, you know, being silenced by his superiors, he's not emotionally, he's not viscerally reacting.
Mm-hmm.
He's hurt by it, clearly. You know, and he did suffer physically, I think, from it. I think his weakened heart came from being, you know, a broken heart.
Yeah.
Really. He literally had a broken heart.
Yeah.
Because the people, you know, his very brothers in the Society of Jesus, you know, were the ones, in a sense, who turned against him. And you know, even at his death, no one was there. Only he was living at St. Ignatius Parish, and it was just the Jesuit superior and, like, the novice. In fact, I ran into someone who was the novice when Teilhard died.
Mm.
He left the society and got married, and he and his wife were at a talk I gave last month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
wow.
I mean, it's pretty amazing.
That must have been an interesting re-encounter.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
And you know, and they were telling me in the brief amount of time I had with them, you know, Teilhard was so, he was not only ordinary, he was sort of, at the end of his life, you have to realize, I think, and appreciate about this, he wanted to die in his own country. France refused to bring him back. They refused to allow him to come back to France.
Was that the Jesuits?
Jesuits.
Yeah.
So to come back to France, he would have had to leave the Jesuits.
Mm.
Correct. And therefore, he could not die in his own country. He was sent to New York City. I once heard Joseph Donders once say, you know, I want to go home and die under the tree on which I was born. You know, and there's something about dying in your own homeland. And that was denied Teilhard. So he not only lived a life where he was suppressed in his voice, in his spiritual writings, he was denied the ability to die in his own homeland. And so he was an outsider right till the end. And that's the prophet. You know, what does it mean to be a prophet in our age? What are we willing, really? What really grasps us? I think that's what Teilhard, you know, this was not an intellectual vision by any means. This was something born within his life that was, I think, deeply of God, and that so had grasped his own life. He was willing to give himself entirely to it right until the very end.
Wow.
You know, and it was unmitigated.
You know, one of the beautiful quotes that came by some friends in esoteric work that I work with, but the bottom line is this wonderful line that says, true love demands sacrifice because true love is a transforming force and is already the beginning of union on the higher plane.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautiful, for me, that's a one-line summary of Teilhard's life.
I think that's very true.
But of Jesus's too. That
I would agree.
For me, what really in the true human being moves love from sort of a biological, erotic, compulsive attraction is this whole dimension of sacrifice, which doesn't mean giving up. Sacrificare means to make holy.
Mm.
And I think it's really important to notice that the two
that's
aren't
good,
the same.
Yeah.
Sacrificare.
Mm-hmm.
But what do we have to do? And And my sense, and I guess part of what I'm grappling with here, mm-hmm. is that we're really talking about, when we're talking about love energy, we're talking about, in some deep way, the transformation of sexual energy.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, and the classic kind of black and white has been, well, the way you do it is through celibacy.
Yeah.
Well, that may be one way of doing it. And for those that are called to do it, as Teilhard was, that's the only way you can do it. But that it doesn't mean that, well, you know, I've got to love, I've got to renounce it because it's, you know, I've got to be celibate, because I think there are different paths of crucifixion.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so that when you're transforming love, for, it's like playing close to the fire, but you have to find out what your path is within it.
Mm-hmm.
You say?
Well, you know, he writes about sexual energy in his work, Human Energy, and yeah. he says this is really fundamentally, he feels actually the lack of sexual energy in spirituality, and certainly, you know, in the whole ecclesial sphere, mm-hmm. has been to the absolute detriment.
Oh, sure.
You know, we have thwarted our sexual energy, and that sexual energy is rooted in the cosmos. So he would see that sexual energy as part and part, like it's the whole cosmos is erotic, so
mm-hmm.
to speak.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing is longing for union.
Yeah.
And so. He does a nice job of this in Human Energy. And so it's not about sex or no sex or, you know,
yeah.
it's really about where we find our unity being, you know.
Yeah.
That's the type of love where we're most free. So
right.
it's about so, you know, his famous idea is like, at some point we have to harness our sexual energies towards something or someone.
Mm-hmm.
And he would say towards someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for him, I think Lucille did play a critical role there, but I think he harnesses that sexual energy fully towards this heart of Christ,
right.
you know, that really grasped him.
Right.
And therefore, it's where we find that energy fulfilled in our being, because that's where we come to our truest personnel. That's where we come to our true personhood.
Yeah.
All that we are then flowers in that union.
Yeah.
You know, that's what he's saying.
Yeah.
And so it's not sex for sex or, you know, body for body stuff. I mean, we've so reduced all of this stuff
yeah.
to something that's physical or just bodily or, you know, temporary or something. And we're so superficial about everything. Teilhard's about depth, and he's about depth and union. And so he's saying that we do have this energy that longs to be harnessed into depth and union for the full flourishing of personality, because it's personality that actually contributes to the emergence of the wholeness.
Right.
That it's only when we become our true personhood that whole then flourishes in and through our lives.
Yeah.
You know, so that idea, union differentiates. The more we are in union with another, the more we are ourselves. Because it's the core of ourselves that's the basis of union.
Right.
You know,
right.
and that's the sum of his ideas on.
Right. And so it calls forth the fullness of the other.
Right, exactly.
Right. Yeah.
It calls forth the fullness of the other. I mean, you can't just, you know, even, you know, the term I love you, I mean, even that can fall flat. You know,
mm-hmm.
it can, you know, what does that mean in the full breadth of those words?
Yeah.
You know, what does that involve in the fullness of our life? And it will involve suffering. It will involve self-gift. And where there's self-gift, there's going to be suffering.
Yeah.
You know, because we're going to have demands placed on us that are beyond what we may have conceived. You know,
right.
and that's it. I think love has demands and it has responsibilities, but it calls forth within us, you know, you might say, our deepest sense of self.
Yeah.
You know,
my take on Teilhard so much is that in some way, in whatever he downloaded in those visions that, you know, in his sense of self that took place in the trenches and just beyond, I almost see him as seeing himself as a sort of a holon or, you know, fractal in the emerging body of that one humanity.
Hmm.
And that he understood that in order to be faithful to that he couldn't couple in such a way that he formed an exclusive unit that cut off the
yeah.
whole thing.
But it's not,
and,
I mean, I think
yeah.
we should just say here, it doesn't mean that couples who are married are not.
Yeah.
That's his hecheta. That's his thisness.
Exactly.
So you have, that's the whole, in a sense, of interiority. Who are you or I, you know, who are we in our own interior thisness? And out of that unique personhood, then we find our full flourishing.
Exactly. You know, and if you don't do it honestly, because you can hide behind your celibacy and never get down to the brass tacks of, you know, it may be that what you need is, you know, you just turn numb.
Absolutely.
Rather than, and you hide rather than daring
to
risk your depths.
I mean, you can become very selfish.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
You become all about me. You know, it's all about my needs and my desires and who loves me and who doesn't love me.
And how I'm going on my path and, you know, what God's going to give me because I've been good and I've been celibate all my life, so it better be a big reward.
Yeah.
Well, I think these are really, really important things, baselines to lay down, because Teilhard's a challenge here, and to realize that what he's calling us to is the depth of our own integrity as we experience it in our own heart, and not to some sort of a formal external template.
Absolutely.
Of how the
and
thing
I would,
is done.
I would say, Cynthia, I would call it the depth of our personhood.
Yeah.
He was very keen on personhood, and the one thing we have, truthfully, I want to say, what has been sacrificed in our modern age for progress, for a world of wealth, is human personhood. Mm-hmm. We have lost sight of the person as person. In other words, not what someone does, not what someone does for a living, or how much money one makes, or where one lives, or, you know, what they wear, but person as person, you know, with these looks, and this smile, and this cranky personality, or this wonderful personality, and this way that they walk, you know, the person, and people are starved, I think, for lost personhood. And we are at the end, I think, I hope, of Descartes' dualism, and we need to regain and refine again the human person. Who am I? Identity as person. So that was very keen to Teilhard.
Yeah.
That we recognize person, because that's what God's about. God's not about creation in some bland, you know, way, like in this kind of swooping way. God is about creation in the deeply personal way.
Yes.
You know, the God creates this leaf and this grain of sand and this quark and this atom and this tree and this person, you know, born, as St. John of the Cross once said, if everything was to disappear, it's like God made this whole universe just for me. That's the type of love, a personal love, Teilhard grasped.
So it's really the suchness of each thing.
The suchness, it, or the thisness, as Gotis would say.
Yeah.
The hek chaitas.
Yeah.
That this thing, and this is not that. And so we cannot replace this with that, because they're two different
things.
They're
not replaceable, yeah.
They're not replaceable. Yeah. But think of how our culture operates. Easily replaceable. You know, it's number 21 and number 22. Well, that's okay. You'll just substitute 21 for 22.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you call any public utilities today, who cares who you are?
Call what's your account,
you know, what's your account number, your ID number, your social security number, your password,
your pet's last name.
We're numbers, you know, we are simply numbers. We don't care. We don't care if you're having a good day or a bad day, or we don't care what you look like. We don't care what you're suffering, quite honestly. That's what the culture says. We don't care about you as person. We care about you as account number 224208, you know, and we want to know, did you pay your bill? You know, that's all we care about. That kind of culture is a culture that cannot evolve.
Yeah.
It cannot love. It doesn't even know love. Love is a foreign word to it. And that's what we need to find again in a new way.
So toward the end of his life, it's said that when Teilhard was his younger Jesuit friend, Pierre Louis, at one point he kept saying, God is a person. God is a person. Now, can you unpack for us? Clearly didn't mean God is a big guy up in the sky. What does he mean by saying God is a person? And what's in it for us?
Well, I think it goes hand in hand that, so God is not an idea.
Uh-huh.
God is not an abstract force. God's not like the Matrix. You know, God's not like something like a cloud hovering over us. God is deeply personal. And that's why God, the name, In other words, it's not just divinity for Teilhard, it's a name. You know, what is the name of this deeply personal God who deeply loves personally? And that is maybe the beauty of the Christian God, the deep personal nature of God. This is not just sort of like divinity, you know, or like God's having a party in the sky and then creation comes out of it. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a God who is deeply in love with an other. The deep personal nature of divine love. And so I think that spoke important, that again, going back to the Sacred Heart of Jesus for Teilhard, which was really important to him, mm-hmm. the personal love radiating, you know, in the cosmos mm-hmm. for every person and everything. So that the cosmos itself is grounded in personal being, personal becoming, not in some cosmic force of becoming. The force of becoming is personalizing personalization.
Right. So I was one of the ones in my life who's been very, very blessed to have experienced the great love. You know, the experience of standing in the presence of a person whom I utterly love and mm-hmm. who utterly loves me and whom in that love, life is transformed. And I feel I'm seen to the core of the being,
mm-hmm.
and that seeing is blessing and a baptizing and is a calling forth and is a healing and making strong.
Right.
That kind of love, while I know I'm doing the same for him, so there's...
Mm-hmm.
And so when Teilhard is talking about God is a person, I could only say that the experience of God, the experience of intimacy, the experience of what's called forth in you
mm-hmm.
in relationship to this God can't be less than the deepest experience of seeing and being seen, midwifing and being midwifed.
Mm-hmm.
So it really talks about the transparency
mm-hmm.
and the engendering intimacy.
Right.
And those things go right out the window, don't they, if you call God a force, an energy, a
Absolutely.
Principle, a Christ consciousness. I hate the word Christ consciousness, frankly,
uh-huh.
because it takes something which is so personal. You
right.
know? So the relationship with, you know, when this Jesus guy
mm-hmm.
hits you,
mm-hmm.
I mean, when you realize that that... You know, for me, I've told the story sometimes that I had my first communion by accident when I was 20.
Hmm.
I don't know if you've ever heard this story. Most of the people in the room haven't, but I'd been raised Christian Scientist. We didn't do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I went to a church in Ontario with my Catholic roommate. They were having a boy choir there to do the day. I thought I was going to hear a nice boy choir concert from St. Paul's, London. I didn't even notice the talk breaks between the things they were singing until I find out, oh my God, I'm in a communion line. So I'm sitting here, what's going to happen? Well, anyway, we managed to get through it. I managed to take the wafer and consume the wine without making an idiot of myself.
Mm-hmm.
But on the way back to my seat, there was this, oh, that's what's been missing.
Huh.
And, you know, I had no preparation at all, but there was just a real, real sense of being met and of being home for the first time.
Hmm.
And so I could say that my first experience of whether you call it Jesus or Christ
right.
was personal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of the reasons why I've never left the Christian path as exasperated as I get by it
yes.
sometimes.
Right.
Because I felt like it wasn't a something, it was a someone
mm-hmm.
Came into heart to heart. And touched and called me.
Yeah.
And I can't say, sorry, I don't like that guru because you're on the wrong path. Get
right.
me one that has
yeah.
a better program. You know, you don't do that with gurus. Yeah. But it's the sense of the personal and personalizing, I think, is so much the mm-hmm. missing element. And our tendency in inner spiritual dialogue nowadays, in order to make it more universal, more accessible theologically, you know, we tend to turn it into these great big cosmic principles again.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you can't find that transforming force of love in it.
No.
Or at least
no.
I can't. Yeah.
No, I would agree, Cynthia, and I think that's why I think we have to, and at least be honest about where we're coming from, at whatever tradition it is. You know, where is the home? Where do we find our truest self? I think that's what Teilhard would ask us.
Mm-hmm.
Because where you find your deepest and truest self, that's where you find, you might say, the freedom to be yourself, to become something more in this evolutionary path. In other words, we can only grow in love when we are truly free in love. You know, and even your experience of, you know, encountering, you know, taking the Eucharist for the first time and having an experience of divinity or divine love touch you personally, you know, and it's an ineffable experience. I mean, that's what I think deep love is about. It's, we don't put words to it. We don't logic it. We don't dispute it. We don't have back and forth conversations. Love is that ineffable. We're touched by it. We don't touch it. It touches us. We don't grasp God. God grasps us, you know, and grasps us oftentimes when we're not looking, you know, when our defenses are down, when we don't have the arguments or the logic, you know, to put up our barriers. And that's the beauty, is that this deep personal love of God, so deeply intimate in everyone's life in a deep personal way, that your experience is not my experience. It is deeply your experience. And I think God is always there, you know, inviting us into a deeper relationship. But because we are these creatures who have, we do set up, we're fearful because I think we're partial. And I think partial creatures are fearful creatures. We're not yet whole. And therefore, we sort of fear what that hole may be, you know, that we're being drawn into. You know, I think in some ways we keep God at bay. So I like to think of God, you know, years ago there was that that movie, Old God, with George Burns in it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and George would just show up. Mm-hmm. God would show up, say, like in your bathroom or in the kitchen, you know, and, you know, you're just going through and, you know, going, oh, what a day, you know, and then God would say, like, so what's the problem? You know, like, how come you can't let go of this stuff? And you're like, you know, why do you have to challenge me like this? Because you just, like, get away, you know, go away. And God would be like, no, you need to really, you know, you need to just stay with this, you know, and talk to me about it. This fidelity of God, I think, is not to be undermined. That's really what we want to say here. You know, I think I would like to say.
Yeah.
Because there is something about this God who loves every person in this room in such a deep, personal way that you cannot even transfer that experience from one to the other. And yet that same love is what binds us together. You know?
So would you say that the personal is the next level deeper from ego? Because many of us, when you hear God loves us personally, we immediately go into it, because I'm so special.
Yeah, because I'm so wonderful.
But
I think it's the transformed ego.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah.
Bonaventure has a beautiful line in his soul's journey into God where he says at the end of the journey, I don't know if you know, Bonaventure's soul's journey into God begins on the level of creation. It moves into the soul, and then it moves upward into God. And the last, and the seventh stage of that journey, Bonaventure goes through the burning love of the crucified. For Bonaventure, the highest level of union with God is not some kind of, you know, angelic purity. It's right through the cross. And he says, there is no other path than through the burning love of the crucified. It's through suffering and death that we then die into love. And so Bonaventure says at the end, you are the God of my heart, my rock and my portion forever. In other words, the center of my life is now totally taken up into God's life, and God's life is so engraved on my life that there is nothing, you know, whether if this world were to disappear tomorrow, if a tsunami was to come in the next minute, whatever happens, I am indelibly now engraved in God, and God engraved in my heart, and that I know I will live forever in that love.
Yeah, and that's not the ego saying,
that is not
I'll
the ego.
Live forever.
No,
it's
no.
It's the...
That's the transformed heart in God.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
So personhood begins to happen then when you subject yourself fully to this process of unity differentiates and differentiation unifies.
Right. So that, if I can just make this point, because I didn't make it, and then I think maybe we should have a few questions, but I do think, so when we talk about cosmic personalization and this movement in evolution towards the transhuman personalization, we are not talking about a collective whole as if we're all coming together into something homogenized. Actually, the greater the collective unity, the greater the diversity. In other words, as we become more unified, we will become more diversified, but we will be diversity and unity. In other words, the union differentiates even on the collective scale means we may become more Muslim, more Jewish, more Christian, if those religions were to endure up ahead.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be a bond uniting us, you know, a bond of unity, so that the richness of unity is in the expression of diversity. Just as the human person, we are, as person, we're the most complex, most complex unity, but we have the most diversity. You know, a more complex brain, more complex organs. And that's actually, I think, what Teilhard envisions up ahead.
Yeah, you know, I got a real hint of that. We worked for many years in a little group called Spiritual Paths Foundation, where we put together, it was a brainchild of a fellow in, you know, that I knew in Aspen and in California, where we brought together lineage religious teachers from five different lineages to practice and do worship together and study and learn each other's traditions, but from a practice base. So at first, you know, devotions and worship was always the hard point, because they're so particular that we thought we'd give offense. So at first we would do things light. We never did Eucharist. We would, because that might insult our Jewish brothers and sisters. And you know, when our Sufi teacher did Sufism, he never said Allah. He sat us saying Amazing Grace. you know. And finally, the students said, enough of this nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
We're tired of liturgy light. You know, that if we've really grown into one heart, we ought to be able to enter through the particularity of each one's practice.
Mm-hmm.
So we tried it one night. I gave Eucharist. Swami gave full puja in his little orange robes and the surahs. You know, we did a real zikr with Allah and the breathing. And we discovered you could do it because the translator mechanism makes up. You can be fully your own heart in the particularity of another path with no translation.
Right.
And it's to discover that, I think that's what's never understood when people in religious dialogue try and do it with their minds.
Right.
That you don't create oneness by eliminating diversity.
No.
You create oneness by increasing it within a flexible unity.
Absolutely.
And I think that's what Teilhard was seeing so precociously.
Well, if I could take it out of the religious sphere, I mean, there's, you know, two examples I could think of collective, you know, holes harnessing energy, and that was, one is, I went to a Billy Joel concert a few years ago. Oh my God, it's like 30,000 people, you know, gathered. There's Billy on stage. I love Billy Joel, you know. And everyone is singing. At one point, he stopped singing, and 30,000 people were singing. There was a harmony and unity there, you know, gathered around Billy Joel. Second is, last year, Villanova won the NCAA championship. I mean, talk about sacrifice. Kids stood in line for like 2 days. They set up sleepless. The passion. We are capable of such passion when there is a collective, you know, where there's something that's binding us together, and we will do anything. We'll sacrifice whatever. We can have, you know, I will give you everything. I'll give you all my clothes, all my books, all my money, you know, if I can just be with you and celebrate this victory. Mm-hmm. And so there's something, we have a lot of collective cultural religion.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think of football
yeah.
games.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Packers, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, everyone's wearing Packer shirts, Packer, you know, caps. It's like they have habits, you know, what we used to call religious habits.
Yeah.
So now they have, you know, like, and they all, like, you know, look alike. So you can see all these religious things, like, that we would associate with traditional religion, and it's all taking place in culture. But all of this to say is we have the capacity to harness our energies for a collective whole. And when that happens, it's spellbinding. You know, to be in a gathering where there is shared energy, it is transcendent in nature. It takes us out of ourselves. And we are a part of, we just feel ourselves part of something much larger, and it energizes us together for something beyond us. It's transcendent.
Like we intuit that higher being we're being called to form. You know, it's already pre-written in our bones, but we don't know how to find it yet.
Right. We just need to translate what we already have into something that taps into our deep religious dimension of being so that we can collectively harness our energies for the forward movement.
Wow.
You know, of
wow.
life.
Do you want to take a couple of questions from the floor?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Linda.
A reminder, you were going to say something about the Omega.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Linda. Yeah, so I have this website called the Omega Center. It's omegacenter.info. Yeah, the idea is the Teilhardian vision of really, when I say exploring love at the heart of the cosmos, I mean coming into a much deeper understanding of love as our root reality, and then living out of that root reality for a new cosmos, a new world. And so the website is an electronic forum that, on one hand, it has the task of perhaps deepening. So to try, we invite bloggers. We have 4 blogs a month on different topics of exploring. This year, the overall theme is love in an age of distrust. How can we begin to understand love in the midst of, you know, the conflicts of our age? So we kind of begin to explore these things. There's some interviews with me and some other stuff. And then we encourage people to form Omega groups so you can be an Omegan. We do realize this is a new vision, and there's a lot in this to really still unpack and to deepen. And so I do think that small discussion groups are important. You know, we need to sit almost like Alexio Divina. You need to take these things slowly and chew on them. You know, allow them to be assimilated into your own consciousness, your own being, and to allow yourself to be transformed by them. So the Omega Center, I think the 3 prongs are educational in the sense of a deepening of knowledge, inspirational, and formational. And so check it out. Thanks for bringing that up, you know, and become an Omegan. Yeah. Yes, Carol.
I can't grasp this future as being present.
First of all, to live in the present is to live, and this is be Teilhard's thought, to live in the present is to live on the cusp of the future at every moment. Because at every moment we are being invited with a number of different possibilities. I mean, you know, we can look at that in terms of quantum reality and saying that at every moment I am living in multiple states. I am an academic. I am a Franciscan sister. I am perhaps a rocket scientist. You know, and I am a classical pianist because that's really my thwarted dream. You know, but any one of those states becomes reality when then my mind turns towards it and makes a choice for it. So, you know, I then am the academic and the sister because not only am I thinking about that, but I'm actually actualizing that possibility by my awareness and therefore by my choice of that awareness. So future, just to clarify, is that which is always in our midst as the realm of possibilities of that which we can become by the awareness and then by our choice. So this inbreaking of future, or this kind of future as our soul support, means that even in the present moment, the only real that I have is in this realm of possibilities, or that which is coming toward me, in sort of that God is future, that infinite realm of possibilities. That's my real reality, but then I choose what that reality will actualize as. And therefore, it's the actualization of the present that unfolds the future into something new. So that when we talk about Trinity, Teilhard would see that, again, he only uses the language Trinitization. I've only seen it maybe once in his writings. So it's not something that he elaborates on. But he kind of grasps that that as I am being, in other words, fontal source of my life expresses itself in my particular personality by which I make a choice. In other words, there's a source, there's an expression, and there's a breath towards something new, which is a trinitization even in my life. There's a trinitizing that's going on, but trinitization, if I can, and here is my Franciscan piece, Trinity and Christ are interwoven realities, right? You know, so that the trinitization process, the trinitizing is the unfolding of the Christ. And so for Teilhard, I think he sees this as a movement. And maybe the thing, Carol, would be to this, to think of this not in terms of a static framework, think of it in terms of quantum reality. Think of it in terms of, and here I might, you know, maybe to look at the Making All Things New book, you know, where if we look at quantum resurrection and what that might mean, that at any one moment we are living in multiple states. You know, that's our present reality. And then future unfolds when any one of those states are actualized by choice and action. Okay.
You know, I love the Trinity. Why don't we talk about the Holy Spirit? Why don't we say, mention them at least 10% of the time about the Trinity. So what is a poor girl like me to think? Who is the Holy Spirit? What is the Holy Spirit? How does it tie in?
Yeah.
I can ask either one of you. Because you're the Trinitarian expert.
Well, I'd just say for the start of it that you're the victim of about 1,000 years of substance theology. It starts out with the first thing being who is. And so your initial instinct is to divide and conquer. Mm. And the church has set that up for years, the 1,000 years of the Father, the 1,000 years of the Son. You see, the psychological substance theology perceived by differentiation. And what if, as Panikkar said, it's correlative? You can't separate them, and the whole idea of trying to understand one without the other just betrays the hamster cage you're running in. Not by your own fault, but because we are, you know, you're trying to apply last year's tools to break open something that doesn't want to be broken open.
Last year's, I think, wisdom school, or, uh-huh. or living school, or whatever school I've been in, uh-huh. The Holy Spirit was the love between the Father and the Son. Or, well, I have to use these words, I think.
That's fine, yeah.
No longer true? Is that old?
Or no, what? That's fine, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I call it, that. But I don't like it that much. I call it racquetball. Because, you know, it still doesn't.
I think it's a little bit too static.
It's too static.
So
yeah.
The spirit. So I think you have to think of the. I'm trying to think. In other words, if let's take this in terms of love, real love. Like, let's take two people. Have you ever fallen in love?
Absolutely.
Okay, absolutely. Great. So when you fell in love with another, you know, you were drawn to that other. But then there's what's between you. What is that? What drew you? What is it that, you know, when people are falling in love, you think to yourself, why does that person, you know, why can they marry that person? I mean, really, what are they thinking, you know?
Yeah.
Right? Because
I actually heard that after the wedding.
Right? Out there. Because you're thinking, Wow. Yeah, these people are blind, deaf, and dumb, you know? Right? So, first thing we have to say is the spirit is something that's ineffable, that's an electromagnetic field, you know? That's the one thing. It's drawing together. And then it's drawing together in such a way, it's a unitive magnetic field that together, like, when you, I'm going to assume, like, the person that you've loved has drawn you to that person in such a way that you have been bonded so that there's something together that has drawn you together towards something new. Even though you're not melded together, there's something about in that bondedness together. And I think that spirit is both that electromagnetic field of attraction that at the same time is drawing us toward, I mean, the spirit is that future then, you know, that future of attraction towards something more, now in a unitive way. You know, now, and so the spirit, I don't know, it's Cynthia, you know, but I think what the spirit symbolizes for me is that life is constantly open toward more life. You know, and the spirit is that breath of life. It's like this arrow, this breath of God's love is open toward infinite love, infinite depth, infinite becoming.
Yeah, I think that'll...
Is that getting...
Yeah. I think that's fine for
yeah.
me.
Yeah, so yeah. it's not so static, you know, like... that's fine, you know, but, and that's fine, really. That's a good start. Really. Yeah. And what we take what we have known, and now we try to understand it in light of what we now know, so that we move forward. And why that's important is because the spirit is really the power of love. By that we mean the power of freedom, the power of newness, the power of the future. It's that power of God that is still creating, you know, and that's dynamic.
Intrinsic purposiveness. In creation,
yeah.
There is a, you know, a purpose, it has intentionality. I think that's one of the things that
word.
That's
yep.
a Teilhard. The creation has intrinsic conscious intentionality, and we can feel that, and we can feel that in our own hearts because we're still made out of the same stuff. But this doesn't translate easily into a plan. I mean, that sort of dumbs it down. Just like when people ask for meaning and you try and give them explanation. They're different orders. And I think that as we nurture the heart, we're able to gradually fall below this language of planning and you know, me and explanation and, you know, the little boxes, to live with that jagged heart perceivable understanding that the whole thing does hang together, but not by any rule book, not by any strategic planning. It's what we meet in our own heart matches what's blown macro as the divine in creation. Thank you, Ilya, for a great day.
Thanks.
Love you. And we'll get to say formal goodbyes tomorrow.